Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live January 20th, 2008. As all of us know, we're in the midst of a digital communication revolution, and no doubt on the front lines of this revolution are children and young people. Today we're going to have as our guest the author of a brand new book on the digital generation and one of the leading experts and activists on media policy, Catherine Montgomery, joining us today on Media Matters. But first, before we go to Catherine Montgomery, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Internet pioneer Dave Hughes is hanging up his web spurs this week after 23 years of providing internet access in Old Colorado City. The 79-year-old retired Army colonel, known as the Cursor Cowboy, began offering email and other services in 1984. Hughes started one of the first computer bulletin boards in 1980 to foster community discussions about politics. He named it Roger's Bar, after a watering hole he frequented.
It's the New England Town Hall over an electronic back fence in Colorado. That's what Roger's Bar was. Millions of people in America can talk directly, unfiltered by media or any other intervention. And as a consequence, can make up their mind by not just what they see in the paper, what they hear on the radio, but also ask questions and get answers and make up your own mind.
Hughes hooked up poor rural areas to wireless internet with grants from the National Science Foundation. He tells the story of how he connected up the schools in the little town of San Luis, Colorado, where U.S. West wanted $2,000 a month for a T1 line.
So I go down there with that grant, buy two of these frequency hopping radios, and connected them up doing the same thing at zero added cost.
Hughes has helped broaden access to the net from towns in Montana and Mongolia to pubs in Wales and even the base camp at Mount Everest. He says that using unlicensed wireless spectrum is creating a device-centered, worldwide revolution in how people communicate, and it's very cost-effective. So how come local, state, and federal government hasn't gotten on board with his ideas?
It's not the devices. It's the uses. The phone companies hate this. Free communications? Are you kidding? AT&T wants to take the money in. The idea that I can sit here and communicate free to somebody else is a direct threat to the service business of the phone companies.
For his next project, Dave Hughes will be documenting the history of Old Colorado City. He's still online at oldcolo.com. That's oldcolo.com.
The FCC will soon start auctioning off a chunk of the public airwaves, known as the 700 megahertz spectrum. Free Press campaign director Timothy Carr discusses the auction's impact in this special guest commentary.
The introduction of the iPhone in 2007 promises a future where internet access is something we can carry with us wherever we go. But having the internet in your pocket raises thorny questions about the policies that have allowed cell phone companies to control our wireless experience in America. The problem is that surfing the web from handheld devices such as the iPhone will never be a true internet experience as long as powerful wireless companies dictate access. Unlike the wired internet, where you're free to surf anywhere online using the computer of your choice, open access via cell phones is not guaranteed. It is granted or denied by your wireless company. You see, for years, they have pushed a business model where they lease and subsidize handsets for consumers. A cheap phone seems like a great deal, but it's a devil's bargain that penalizes you with high termination fees, crippled applications, and gated web access. But this could change. On January 24th, the Federal Communications Commission is preparing to auction off an invaluable chunk of public airways that, if used right, could make a more mobile web a reality for tens of millions of Americans. In an effort to break open the wireless marketplace, internet rights groups such as Free Press have pushed for open access conditions that require all companies using these airwaves to open their networks to more devices, innovation, and competition. The FCC is showing more interest in moving in this direction as well. But the dominant carriers still call the shots, and they're reluctant to loosen their near total control over a lucrative marketplace. AT&T and Verizon are now jockeying to buy up licenses to these new airwaves, hoard access, and build new roadblocks to the mobile web. Continued pressure from wireless users and public interest groups may yet succeed in prying open a wireless marketplace, turning the buzz about having the internet into your pocket to more than just hucksterism and hype. The iPhone was our wake-up call. The coming airwaves auction is our first chance to get busy in the fight for an open wireless internet.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Well, okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana here on January 20th, 2008. Our guest today, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, is one of the leading experts on the internet, on children and media in the United States, both as a scholar and activist. Catherine Montgomery is a professor of communication at American University in Washington, D.C., where she directs the Project on Youth Media and Democracy. She's also a founder for the Center for Media Education and the author of a brand new book, or relatively brand new book, just came out a few months ago, Generation Digital, Politics, Commerce, and Childhood in the Age of the Internet. We're honored to have her as our guest today. Kathy Montgomery, hello.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
Well, it's delighted to have you here, Catherine Montgomery, and as you know, I'm so keen on this book that I actually assigned it to my large class in fall 2007. It's fresh off the presses. And it was, I can say safely, a superb introduction and analysis of the extraordinary changes going on in childhood as a result of the digital revolution. What do you mean? You call it Generation Digital is your title. What are you getting at with that, and why is it important in your view?
Well, first of all, thank you for using the book, and thank you so much for your complimentary remarks about it. I think what's so important is that this generation is growing up amid tumultuous changes in our media system. And in many ways, young people are being defined by new media. It is a central part of their experience in growing up, and increasingly they're living their lives in this new digital media culture. In addition to that, they have been defined in the marketplace through a lot of hype in the marketplace as very, very important to the future of new media. And they're also early adopters. They really are kind of pioneers out there using new media in very new ways and helping to kind of lead the way for everybody else. And then finally, they've been at the center of public debate about the media culture. And that's one of the things I wrote about in the book, the many policy debates, ongoing debates about children in the media system. So they really have played a lot of different roles, and they continue to do so.
Well, we're going to go through some of those policy debates, which you chronicle in your book, and there are many more coming up in front of us as well. But before we go any further, let's talk a little bit about exactly how sweeping you think the digital communication developments or revolution or system is in terms of childhood. How does it compare in your view, for example, to the advent of television in the 1950s, which I think, I'm not going to date you, but I'll certainly date myself and say I was really the first generation that was immersed in television from, you know, in very early age onward. And, you know, it's often argued this had a dramatic effect on how the generation of the 60s and 70s saw the world. Do you think this compares with that, or greater or lesser? What's your sense in historical comparison?
Well, it is very interesting. I will tell you and your listeners that I, too, am a product of the television era. And I have often asked my students over the years, when I give them a little introductory quiz, if they can remember the first time they ever saw a television set. I can. And it was a memorable moment when my father brought one home, and suddenly we were not the We weren't the first family on our block to have one, but it was a notable time, a notable event. This is a new thing coming in, whereas young people growing up since then have grown up with television as a part of the family. There was never any question. It was just there, and their relationship to it is just, the, you know, built into their experience. And I think increasingly this is what we're seeing with new media. But the other important thing to know about the digital generation and the digital media is that the new media have become part of so many different aspects of our lives. We're not just talking about a medium that brings you information and entertainment in the world that occupies your time. We're talking about something that is an integral part of how you interrelate with other people, how you learn about the world, how you work, how you shop, how you conduct your role as a citizen. So the digital media have become very pervasive and very much integrated into all aspects of our experience. And young people are growing up with these media as part of all of their experiences.
Our guest today, Catherine Montgomery, professor of communication at American University, founder of the Center for Media Education, and the author of the new book, Generation Digital, Politics, Commerce, and Childhood in the Age of the Internet. If you'd like to call in and speak with Catherine Montgomery here on Media Matters, the number is 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Before we go into the details, Professor Montgomery, I do have one question for you in general. This is a topic, as you know better than anyone, is filled with either people who are, I guess the way to put it is they're extreme perspectives on this issue, ranging from great alarm and great concern about what's going on with digital media for children on one hand, and then sort of celebrations of how wonderful this is on other hand. Where would you fall on that spectrum?
Well, I mean, and that's one of the things I write about in the book as well, that we have seen these two extremes. Either it's terrible, we're so worried that kids are going to be stalked, that they'll be in terrible danger going online, to the other extreme that it's changing everything and, you know, anything goes is no problem. A lot of hope, I think, associated with the new media as well. I see both. You know, I mean, I have written about both. I see it in a very kind of complex way, that we're talking about a medium, I think, that has tremendous potential. I don't think that potential is necessarily overrated. I don't think it's always fully understood. But I think that the role of the new media as arenas for participation, that's very important, and many young people are embracing new media, and I think that new media are playing an important role in their involvement in politics in this election, in the election of 2004. It has the ability, the new media environment has the ability to re-engage people and to engage them in many, many new ways. At the same time, I think there are real concerns about a lot of the issues that have been raised over the years about safety, for example. I think often that gets the whole worry about pornography and indecency gets caught up, of course, in the cultural debates about media that have been going on for a long time. But they also sometimes divert attention away from other developments that I am concerned about as well, and that's particularly the growth of the marketplace and the exploitive ways that marketers are going after young people in the new media. So in many ways, there are lots of different aspects of this new media environment that we're looking at, this new media culture. And we're at a very important moment here where we as a society need to look at the whole picture and focus on what we can do to ensure that the new media serve the needs of our young people.
Catherine Montgomery, before we go into more detail on marketing, advertising, and the policy issues, which is really the guts of your book, there was one thing that occurred to me as I read the book, and that was the media scholar, the late, great Neil Postman, as I'm sure you're familiar with him, had an argument, and he was an educator too, and a lot of his work was driven by concern about children, had a strong argument that the rise of television in the 50s and 60s was fundamentally a negative media institution in terms of what it did to people's ability to use their intellect, develop their intellect, that reading culture, literate culture, print culture have been far superior in many respects towards building healthy, happy citizens and building healthy, happy societies and democracies. And his book was really a Jeremiah against television in many respects. And I've often wondered what Neil Postman would think of the internet and the digital revolution. He died a few years ago, and I think his general sense was it just extended television. It didn't really make any fundamental alteration in his argument. And I've been thinking about that recently a lot because I was talking to friends of mine who teach at the Ivy League universities, some of the most prestigious universities, and they were just talking about the drop-off in the amount their students are willing to read compared to 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. Even these are the most elite high school and college students in the country. And I wonder what your take is on how that Postman argument, whether it held much water to begin with, you know, does that apply in the digital era? Are we seeing fundamental changes in how people, their commitment to reading or willingness to read?
Well, you know, I think it's too early to know what the ultimate impact will be of the new media system. We're looking at certain trends that we can identify, but I don't know. I think that new media are used often by young people to seek out information and to engage in ways that I think can extend their intellectual pursuits. Whether that will happen or not, we don't know. There is a tendency, I know this just as a professor, and I'm sure you do as well, to use the internet as a shortcut to getting information because there's so much information out there. And sometimes that means that young people are not seeking the other resources in terms of published works. Sometimes it's very hard to get your students to go into the library. You know, I asked them the other day, how many of you actually were in the library in the last 2 months? Well, a handful of them had been. But the internet provides a vast library that can be a wonderful resource and can really be a means by which people seek out information that they read, that they engage in intellectually. It isn't really, I don't think, comparable to television in that way. At the same time, it can be a kind of shortcut to getting quick answers that may circumvent engaging with other works, like books, for example. I don't think it's as simple a situation as some people might see it. I'm not sure what Neil Postman would say about new media. I think he has been always skeptical, was skeptical, certainly was in the last few years of his life when I interacted with him about new media. And I do think there's a legitimate concern, by the way, that many of the powers that be who have created our entertainment culture through television have already moved into the new media. And I think that's a big danger.
And in your book, one of the things, Catherine Montgomery, that you touch on is linking up the debates over new media and digital communication to the rise of cable and satellite TV, sort of, which is an important era both for policy and for implications for children and children's media. Because I remember back in the 1980s when geosynchronous satellites came along, we saw the rapid rise and dominance of cable television with Nickelodeon and Disney Channel and a variety of other channels, Cartoon Network, that came along to be very lucrative by the early 1990s, that this was held up as something that was going to be terrific for children because we would have all these opportunities to educate children with these channels that were not possible when back in the pre-cable television days. What was that promise like and what happened to it?
Well, I lived through that promise because I was actually involved in local cable franchising in the 1970s and 80s in the period that was known as the Blue Skies period, where there was a lot of promise, a lot of hype from the companies who were seeking those very lucrative local franchises, and a lot of courting of local citizenry when they invented the term rent-a-citizen.
And these were monopoly franchises,
yes,
which make clear.
That's right, monopoly franchises. So if you could get the franchise for your cable system to operate in a particular city or a particular community, that was worth a lot of money to you. And it was in the early period of cable television when it was held up with great promise, and I think, in fact, some of that promise has been fulfilled, but certainly not all of it. I do specifically remember the promises made by Nickelodeon and the fact that you as a cable operator could be a hero on your block by adding this to your array of new channels that you would offer commercial free. And it was in the middle of a lot of the debates over the quality of children's media on television when Nickelodeon sort of came riding in on a white horse to say, look, we will solve the problem here with cable television because we're going to provide an alternative. And within a very short period of time, and I think this was on the agenda all along, within a very short period of time, that channel transitioned to a very, very commercial channel and also forged the way to a new powerful marketplace of programming targeted at children alone, targeted not at families, but at children as a very, very valuable demographic, and positioning kids to have a very separate kind of media culture. Now, ultimately, you know, the quality of that media culture isn't so bad, but at the same time, if you look at how it has driven the growth of marketing and advertising and pushing of products to young people, that I think is very much a worry.
Our guest today, Catherine Montgomery, author of the new book, Generation Digital, Politics, Commerce, and Childhood in the Age of the Internet. Catherine Montgomery is the founder of the Center for Media Education based in Washington, D.C., and also is a professor of communication at American University. Our phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Catherine Montgomery.
Hello.
Yes. It seems that, you know, if I want to get a political view from the far left to the far right, I can find it on the Internet or possibly even locally. But when it comes to state politics, it's kind of a wasteland in many ways. And I'm wondering if you found with the upcoming digital generation that any interest in the state issues has become lessened by this?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I do see more young people becoming involved in politics and in some public policy issues. Whether those issues are local ones, is not necessarily the case. And so I don't know that automatically the medium will make that happen, make them more engaged. I think there is a need to have an infrastructure of organizations that educate and mobilize young people at the state level, and there are groups that do that. So that we're not talking about a medium coming in and changing everything. We're talking about a medium that works in conjunction with a civil society, in conjunction with organizations that are set up to involve people in important policy matters and important government matters, whether it is national or at the state level.
Well, let's go now to line 4, Coles County. Line 4, you are now on the air with Catherine Montgomery, author of Generation Digital.
Yeah, I thought I would make a mention of what I consider to be the dumbing down of American college students over the last 25 years. Seems to me that starting in earnest in about in the early 1980s, about 25 to 30 years ago, you saw a tremendous decrease in interest in reading newspapers, reading magazines, reading books. So although this is a very serious matter and it's probably got even worse today, I will have to admit I do not think it's a consequence, though, of the Internet or the digital age. I don't think it's a consequence of that at all. It's something which unfortunately started occurring even before most students had any access to digital information. So that's just a comment I thought I would make.
Well, thank you very much. Okay. Thank you very much, caller. Catherine Montgomery, do you have anything to reply to that?
Well, there's a real concern about disengagement among young people with the political process. That is a long-term trend that we have been seeing over decades, and it has been accompanied by and is certainly related to young people not paying as much attention to news. We know, for example, they don't watch television news. They don't watch network news. You can see that if you look at the shows and see it's all all the advertising is for drugs for older people, for pharmaceuticals. They don't read newspapers very much, and that's been very troubling to a lot of people. I think it's a very, very legitimate concern. I think that we have an opportunity to reengage young people. We've seen some areas where they are engaged, and I think we need to figure out how to encourage them to continue along those lines. For example, we know that young people are getting some of their public information about politics and other public affairs information from comedy shows like The Daily Show, like Bill Maher, for example. And that may not necessarily be an illegitimate way to get your news, to be engaged in politics. I guess I am an optimist and always want to look at where we can encourage the kinds of changes that could reengage young people and highlighting some of those things. The youth vote was up in the 2004 election, although the reports initially from the press indicated that wasn't the case. Many people still think that young people will not be engaged, will not be involved in politics. And I have to believe that there's hope that they can be and that they will be.
Catherine Montgomery, in Generation Digital, you spend a lot of time chronicling the debates, the policy debates in Washington, D.C. in the 1990s as the over both cable television, satellite television, multi-channel television, and the Internet. And one of the issues that you worked on and you're familiar with is a term that was very common a decade ago, which has fallen from view, but you write about, which is called the V-chip. Talk a little bit, if you would, about what the V-chip was all about and what happened to it.
Well, my experience with the V-chip, it was in many ways one of my most frustrating and yet most interesting experiences in the policy arena here. And I've often said that my two most humbling experiences over the last 15 years or so have been, one, raising a child, which I think is very, very humbling and very challenging, and two, coming to Washington and trying to affect any changes in media policy. The V-chip was an issue that came out of decades of concern about the impact of television violence on young people. And I sort of got dragged into this issue in some ways because I was very, very leery about any legislation that would restrict content on television. Even though we knew that violent content can be harmful to young people, I think we must be very, very careful about how that's handled from a public policy point of view. But the V-chip was a concept invented in Canada that certain policymakers thought would be a good, easy way to address the problem of TV violence and just equip all the TV sets with these little chips that could then block out programming. The problem with the V-chip is that it wouldn't work unless you had a system for rating programs, and the industry itself was encouraged to develop a rating system. That's when I got involved, because the industry did not want to listen to the concerns of parents about labeling the content that was violent. And instead, under the leadership of Jack Valenti at the Motion Picture Association, the same agency that created the movie ratings, they came up with a similar system of age-based ratings. And I became involved on behalf of a whole group of child advocates and health and education groups, PTA groups, American Medical Association, psychologists, etc., to get the industry to change its rating so that it would include the content. And it was a very difficult thing to do. There was pressure from Congress to do it. We had a series of negotiations with the industry, and we crafted finally a very convoluted set of labels that that now include not only TV-14 but also DSLV. We were able to hold the industry accountable, and I feel very good about that. But the what came out of it, unfortunately, because of the very nature of the politics of it all, was a little bit complex and not easy to understand. And in fact, when those ratings run for the first 15 seconds of every TV show, my husband sometimes turns to me and says, well, you always did want to write for television. And it has become a very funny inside joke among us. But it was really... I think what was important is that the advocacy groups were very involved in this issue, and the industry was not able to get away with coming up with a rating system that it wanted to. It was forced to, in fact, at least acknowledge that there was violent content in the programming.
When the V-chip came along, Catherine Montgomery, and the debates for, and it got quite a bit of attention, the debates for pronounced in the mid to late 1990s, a friend of mine, an academic who's from Europe, came storming into my office and said, why aren't they debating the A-chip for children? And I said, what are you talking about? The advertising chip.
Right. Yes.
Why do we allow any advertising on the airwaves
right.
to go to children? This is obscene. We don't allow this in Europe. Why are you marinating children's brains in advertising? He was frothing. Why was there no debate about the A-chip?
Well, you know, there have been debates about advertising for many years in the U.S., and that's something I have been very familiar with and was indirectly involved with way, way back in the 1970s when advocacy groups, for very good reason, tried to get advertising off of children's television. And the Federal Trade Commission attempted to actually launch an effort to do that. And the industry fought back with incredible power and with threats, and ultimately went to Congress to stop that effort, and that weakened the Federal Trade Commission. And it's really unfortunate that that debate didn't happen until advertising had become so firmly entrenched in television programming and in the television system that politically it was practically impossible to reverse that. What we did do, because I've always been concerned about advertising, was to make an intervention in the early part of the Internet at a point when a lot of people didn't even know there was advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And we were tracking the fact that the same advertisers that had been going after children on television had moved online by the mid-90s, very shortly after the development of the World Wide Web, when the Internet was becoming a mass medium. And they were using a whole range of techniques to target children, no holds barred, no rules. And we launched a campaign in the mid-1990s that addressed that and was really trying to get at advertising to children on the Internet early on with a campaign that would have some impact and help prevent, you know, further exploitation. As the result of that, we were able to get a law passed that has had some positive impacts on advertising. I think we realized from the beginning it would be impossible to get rid of advertising altogether, but what we wanted were rules of the game. How are you going to market to children? And one of the things we were able to get is a law called the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which restricts the amount of information collected from young people. And in fact, has changed the way marketers operate with young children. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of data collection going on with teens, and that's an issue, by the way, that I'm still involved with. I haven't stopped being an advocate, even though I closed my Center for Media Education in 2003 when I went back to full-time teaching, because there are efforts by groups like the Center for Digital Democracy and US PIRG, and the Electronic Privacy Information Center to go to the Federal Trade Commission to try to get them to do something about privacy and data collection in the increasingly commercialized social networks like MySpace and Facebook, that are going after young people.
My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. In coming weeks, we're going to have as our guest David Sirota, the newspaper columnist, Stephen Kinzer, the former New York Times reporter and expert on U.S. foreign policy. We'll have Juan Gonzalez, Naomi Wolf, Arianna Huffington. We've got a full line of terrific guests. And today, our guest again, Catherine Montgomery, author of the new book, Generation Digital, Politics, Commerce, and Childhood in the Age of the Internet. Phone lines are open at 333-9455 and our toll-free number at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line four right now. Chicago, hi. You're on the air with Catherine Montgomery.
Hi. You were talking a while ago about the dumbing down of students. They're not willing to read and take advantage of libraries and so on. It occurs to me that what they do is spend a heck of a lot of time wasting time on such things as getting their kicks from movie stars and sports and that sort of thing. Well, because it's a lot easier. There's no work for them to do. All they have to do is sit and look, and that's about it. Be titillated. It occurs to me that the only way to attack this problem is to limit the amount of sports and the movie industry and that sort of thing considerably, so that those businesses cannot form the basis for the titillation of the students and the rest of the population as they grow older.
Well, I think that's a tough one. I think, you know, we do live in a free society, and it's very difficult to restrict what these media companies can do. This is a very engaging culture. There's no question about it, that young people are engaged in entertainment media. It's extremely powerful. It's very pervasive in sports as well. I don't know that I would quite share such a negative view of the situation, however. I think that it's true young people spend a lot of time with celebrities and a lot of time with entertainment media, with movies. But I don't think all of that is worthless. I think there can be very valuable content. I think having them engage in media that entertain them may also be an opportunity to educate them. And there certainly have been many entertainment programs, for example, that also include, you know, educational content, that include opportunities for people to learn about the world. So I don't think the right way to go at it is to restrict and, you know, somehow stop these companies from creating material that's engaging for young people. I think we as educators, and that is fundamentally what I do, and that pertains to all the educators for young people, the youngest up until the university age, need to find ways to engage people within this media culture, and perhaps involving the media culture with ourselves in, you know, addressing the media culture in what we teach, that will connect what matters to young people to what we believe is important for them to be engaged citizens.
You know, Kathy Montgomery, a lot of the talk, and I think some of the discussion today is premised on how people use the new technologies and the kids especially and children, how they take advantage of them, become producers, they interact with them. A lot of your book, though, also goes into some detail in how extraordinarily powerful marketing forces are using the new technologies to get access to and influence children. And I was really surprised, and I study this area a little bit on the side, at some of what's going on. And I even have, you know, a child, a daughter roughly the same age as your daughter, same name, by the way.
Oh, right.
So I was, maybe for the sake of our listeners, explain a little bit about what the marketing community is doing, how they're tackling the World Wide Web and the Internet and digital revolution to open up new avenues to children.
It was so interesting to me is that what is going on in terms of marketing targeted to our children in the digital media is happening under the radar of most parents. I mean, most of us are aware of commercials, and we can rail about them, and we see them coming at us and coming at our kids on TV, and we get very upset. But what we may not realize, or what most people don't realize, is that advertising has now been integrated into really every aspect of the new digital media culture. I talked earlier about the law that we got passed that has placed some restrictions on marketers who are going after children under the age of 13. And as I document in my book, those restrictions have affected the market and have meant that certain protections are in place for young people under that age group. But over the whole, if you look at the, all of the digital media, it is unbelievable how many different ways marketers can get to our kids. I just did a report that is published online called digitalads.org about food marketing, which is really emblematic. It shows all the different ways that marketers go after kids. We use the example here of food and beverages, which are contributing to the obesity problem. But I'm talking about commercials that are now on cell phones that will offer free coupons to kids so that they can go to the McDonald's and get a new McFlurry, or ads that are woven into all of the interactive games and increasingly are targeted to individuals and will be coming at people, at young people and at adults, in real time and tailored specifically to you. We're talking about a new marketing paradigm, really, a new way of marketing that is tailored to individuals and that is based on data collection and profiling of everything you do online. You think about when you go to a library to look up a book or to look up something in your life. Let's say you want to research a disease you think you have. You go to the library, you look things up, you walk through the stacks, you open books, you gather information about something, and you do that with the knowledge and the trust that nobody else is going to know what you're doing. You don't have a librarian or some other person following you around the library. But you go online and use a search engine, and the marketers, the way it's built into the system, the marketers are following every move you make and keeping a record of that. And
well, isn't that a good...
is the way it's being done in the new digital marketplace.
Now, some would say that's a good thing because it'll help the economy because they can tailor products and messages just to you and your actual needs and not waste your time with stuff you're not interested in.
And that's that is one of the potential benefits that, you know, it will mean. And it just if you look at something like Amazon.com, for example, you go on there, you look at books, you know, next time you go on there, it remembers you look for those books, and it gives you a few more suggestions. And that's not a bad thing. That's okay. But what we're talking about is sometimes when you're online, you're not online to shop. When I'm online to look up something I'm concerned about, for example, I'm not there because I want somebody to follow me so they can market to me. So that's part of it, that these marketers are intruding into areas of your life in the digital media that aren't about marketing, where you didn't give them permission to do that. The same is true with the social networks, MySpace, Facebook. Those are very, very rapidly being, quote, monetized, as it's spoken of in the business, which means that everything becomes fair game. So you're on there as a teenager because you want to talk about your favorite movie stars and you want to relate with your friends and whatever else. But marketers are there in some ways sort of lurking to take advantage of every single thing you say about yourself and what you do and where you go to tailor messages that are for you. And these aren't necessarily straightforward messages. Sometimes they can be pretty manipulative. I mean, I document in my book examples for an illustration of what they call word of mouth advertising, where young people are given telephone messages with the voice of a celebrity, you know, and we're talking about teenagers here who have varying degrees of sophistication that's endorsing a product and that is really not necessarily straightforward and not necessarily fair, and oftentimes we're talking about advertising that could be very deceptive.
Now, isn't this something that people can just not go to those websites that do this, or
it's,
I mean, it's how much of it is the responsibility of the child to avoid this, or the adult for that matter? And how much is a public policy concern?
It's so pervasive that it's something you can't really avoid. I do think there are public policy issues, though, particularly around data collection and privacy. And I am working with the Center for Digital Democracy on complaints to the Federal Trade Commission. You can expect to see some additional complaints being brought against some of these social networking platforms because they're not really being open and fair and transparent about what they do. That's one of the big problems. You can't opt out of something or even decide not to opt in if you don't know what they're doing. So to the extent that consumers will need to be more educated about all of these things in order to navigate this new digital media environment, there have to be some rules about what marketers do and what they don't do, and whether they're clear to their consumers, young and old alike, about what how they're collecting data and how they're marketing to them. It's a whole new era.
Our guest, Catherine Montgomery, author of Generation Digital. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I think a lot of what you're talking about is sort of education or sophistication and discernment about information, and the fact that now we, young people especially, are so capable of having access to a great deal of information about the society. My question is, as educators, do you really think that the students of today are really more sophisticated with respect to, like, knowing what's happening in the world than, like, we were, like, say, I'll date myself, relative to Vietnam, like, the student body led the efforts, of course, we were being drafted, against the war in Vietnam, for instance, like, compare and contrast how our student body now is, like, relating to, like, the Iraq conflict, and maybe is the country really already decided it's more of a market and not a country?
I think there is something to be said for that. Are they more engaged and involved? It's hard to make a blanket statement about that. I can speak about my students, and certainly I do think that there's one thing that's happening with the media culture. There are sort of, conflicting kinds of tendencies here. On the one hand, yes, they are more involved, more aware. If you go to some of the social networking sites, for example, you can see campaigns about Darfur. You can see all kinds of political efforts going on, political activism. And I've also written about students and groups that use the new media for political activism. At the same time, I think the media culture, and particularly because of the role of marketing, is in some ways more narcissistic, that it's encouraging us to be more focused on ourselves, our individual selves, our friends, our needs, what we buy, what our identity is all about. And the other thing is that the marketing is so tied into the developmental processes for young people who are seeking their identities and seeking to establish their social relationships. And now this market culture is interwoven with that. So it sort of goes both ways. And ultimately, I don't know where that's going to take us. You know, will young people be more involved, or will they be obsessed only with what it's where it intersects with their own personal lives? And that goes for the rest of us.
Kathy Montgomery, we're in the midst of a presidential electoral season, since it seems the proper term given the sports terminology that
right.
to describe it in
that
the news media.
That starts earlier and earlier.
That's right, and goes longer and longer.
That's right, yeah.
But allowing for that, if you could give a wish list of the two or three policies you wished were being debated and ideally enacted that would positively change the media experience of children for the better and force politicians to address, what would those two or three policies be?
Well, I think the issue of privacy that I've been talking about is a very important one. How do we protect consumer privacy in the new digital media culture? And that's not being talked about. In fact, some of the same practices that the marketers use are being used by the political campaigns themselves to target individuals and to collect data. So But I do think that's an important issue. I think we need to support programs that are aimed at educating young people and using the media to do so. There have been attempts to get funding, for example, through Congress to support the development of proactive positive initiatives to harness media to benefit young people. We need to push for more of that. And
could you give an example that what that means tangibly?
Well, to look at developing support mechanisms for young people to create websites and so forth, to find some models. I mean, there's nothing really in Congress now. There have been attempts for, you know, to address these issues over the years. How do you create support for non-commercial content? If you look at what we looked at with public television and public broadcasting, how does that translate into the new era? How does that translate into digital? How can we create programming that's not based on the market, for example? How can we have a debate about doing that so that everything doesn't become part of the marketplace and driven by the marketplace and mm-hmm. shaped by the marketplace?
Are there any candidates that you've seen running for president for either party who've shown any interest in these issues at all?
No. I will say that Hillary Clinton has shown concerns about children's media issues, primarily, you know, concerns about violence and video game violence and so forth. Not as much about the marketplace. I'd like to see her and others look more at the marketplace. But for the most part, it hasn't been as much on the agenda. I mean, interestingly, during previous campaign cycles and elections, the media, the VCHIP, for example, was invoked in the presidential elections during the Clinton era. We're not seeing much about media now.
And do you think this is an issue? I mean, you've done a lot of political work on this. When your history of organizing through to the present day, is this an issue that breaks down with liberals and Democrats wanting to aggressively go after this issue and conservatives and Republicans preferring to let business interests do as they please?
Well, not necessarily. The privacy issue, for example, concerns both liberals and conservatives. It is true that there are differences in how you go about it. What's the role of government? And that can break down with liberals supporting government's involvement more than conservatives. But I think when it comes to issues like consumer privacy, those cut across the ideological lines.
And what about the religious conservatives, the Christian conservatives, who explicitly put so much emphasis on families and children and morals and ethics and getting away from the corruption, the corrupting influences? I would assume commercialism would probably not be, it's not really written about in the Bible very much.
No, and there tends to be support, I think, across the board when you look at commercialism. And when you're looking at families and children, that is an issue that cuts across, no question. And I don't base that so much on research that looks at it, on polling research, although there has been some over the years. But just in terms of talking to parents and families and various constituencies.
How about other nations?
I don't think it is ideologically. Yeah.
Kathy Montgomery, how about other nations who are facing the exact same issues that the United States is facing today concerning children and the Internet and marketing and privacy? Are some other nations doing it differently?
Well, the UK has come down on food marketing in a pretty strong way, making some restrictions on what marketers can do on television, certainly. With respect to young people. Other countries have had much stronger policies over the years. In Sweden, for example, restricting advertising, not permitting advertising to children. I think we're seeing some changes with digital media that are kind of challenging that because the borders aren't as easily drawn as they were before. And so those countries, I think, are facing some challenges at, keeping some protective measures in place with regard to the commercial marketplace. But there has been a different tradition, certainly. And I think the tradition here in the U.S. has been very pro-market and very, you know, we haven't had strong tradition, for example, as strong a tradition as elsewhere for public service broadcasting. It's always been in a very weak position, public television here, public broadcasting. So I don't think we measure up as well in that way.
How well do you think our news media in the United States do covering the issues you write about in your book?
Oh, I don't think well at all, but I think our news media are in, you know, a crisis themselves in terms of how they've evolved and how caught up they are in the marketplace and how trivial so much of journalism has become, which is very troubling. You know, they will cover, what happens, I find, is that the news media will cover issues that are sensational. So this whole story recently about the girl, I mean, it was a terrible story, who committed suicide because the father of her neighbor created a fictional character on MySpace who was supposed to be, you know, cultivating a relationship with her, and it ultimately did it to kind of, you know, harass her and ultimately drove her to suicide. That's the kind of thing that gets a huge amount of media attention. Or the, you know, concerns about online safety. But the marketplace issues are seldom focused on at all, and that's why they have been kept, they're pretty much a well-kept secret.
And then we're about to wrap up here, Kathy Montgomery, but before we do, now with your new book, Generation Digital, it sort of cements your role returning to academia some 5 years ago as a professor at American University. You're in the same field I am of communication. How good of a job do you think academics are doing and scholars are doing and media scholars are doing in the United States in examining these issues that you're pursuing, teaching our students about them, and basically doing our job in the public interest?
I think we could do a lot more. I think, you know, there are some new efforts underway to look at digital media. The MacArthur Foundation is funding some work in that area. There's not much that really looks at the marketplace. That's the amazing thing to me, is that, you know, this is a huge, powerful set of industries, and there's not a lot of scholarship that examines that. You know, I mean, the work you've done has been terrific, and just a handful of scholars do it, and do it in a public way, a way that enables the public to understand. Too often academic research is so narrow and inaccessible and really doesn't serve the public interest, and I think we as educators have an obligation to do so.
And what are your plans forthcoming now that you've got this book out and is gaining publicity? Where do you go from here, Catherine McKenna?
Well, I'm working on a new graduate program at American University, and I'm also looking further at what's happening with social networks and youth civic engagement, and continuing to work on the marketplace. There's a lot to be done there, and I think there will be some interesting and important debates in Washington, and I'm weighing in on them.
And the Center for Media Education, the group you founded, you said, has no longer in existence. It's had a 15-year history? How long?
About 12 years. We've closed that group. I'm continuing my advocacy work with other groups like the Center for Digital Democracy and a coalition of other groups involved with children, youth, and media, and continuing a lot of the work through the university as well.
I hear the band tuning up in the background, Kathy Montgomery, which means they want to clear me out of the studio and get on to the next show. I want to thank Catherine Montgomery very much for being my guest today. Catherine Montgomery is the author of Generation Digital, Politics, Commerce, and Childhood in the Age of the Internet. My name's Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle for being my producer, Matt for working the board this Sunday. Thank you so much. And I'll be back 1 week from today with David Sirota. Until then, have a great week, everyone.